Dodge versus Schumacher. Mr. Zisk.
That's Zisk, Your Honor. I apologize for the difficult name. Good morning. May it please the court.
This is How do you pronounce your name?
Zisk.
Zisk?
Just like the German judge.
That's fine. That's good.
This is a case involving a guarantee. It is a case that came up on cross summary judgment motions with full stipulated facts. It's not your ordinary case. We don't see guarantee law cases much these days, but there is a great body of seminal cases in guarantee law in Illinois and throughout the country and even back into English law. Guarantees are a special kind of contract, and in fact, these contracts are between they really involve three different people. It's a triangular arrangement. There is the creditor and the obligor, and then waiting in the wings is the guarantor. The guarantor waits in the wings and is not on the main stage, but rather waits for something to happen, something dramatic, and something bad to happen in the relationship of the other two. Now, because, so to speak, the guarantor is waiting in the wings for some indeterminate date in the future to perform under the guarantee, there are two greater risks that occur in terms of a guarantee that don't generally occur in your ordinary contract.
I'll tell you, what I can't figure out, I don't understand what rule you're contending for. So here we have a guarantee that's, you know, very broad, no conditions in it. So you think at some point it terminated with, you know, without anyone knowing it. So what is that? What is the rule exactly that you think?
Well, I think there are really two rules, Your Honor, and they really go to the two major risks in a guarantee situation.
I'm not making myself clear. When do you think this guarantee expired?
I believe it expired about 1990 at the very latest. Now,
what do you mean at the very latest? Don't we have to have a precise date when it expires, or else how do parties to guarantees know what their rights and duties are?
Well, I don't think there is a particular time that all parties can determine together that a guarantee has expired under the law of Illinois. There are facts and circumstances tests for both the reasonable time rule and for the material change doctrine. And where there is, of course, facts and circumstances test, it often is not completely clear to all the parties involved exactly when an event occurs in the law.
What happened in 1990 that precipitated the discharge that you're relying on?
Well, I believe by 1990, there had been a severance of the relationship between Horning and Schumacher, which had originally been the basis and the reason for the guarantee itself.
Why should that bring about a discharge?
Well, the change in the relationship between Horning and Schumacher is the subject of the reasonable time rule. Now, at that point, already nearly 20 years had expired.
Well, those are two different arguments. The change in the relationship between the primary debtor, Horning, and your client, the guarantor, is one line of argument. And it's my understanding there's no case law support for that particular circumstance as precipitating a discharge. Now you're sort of morphing into the reasonable time argument. So,
well, actually, the reasonable time rule and the case law under the reasonable time rule does look to the facts and circumstances of the change in relation, not between the creditor and the obligor, but between the guarantor and the obligor. That is one of the facts and circumstances that is looked to within the reasonable time rule to determine whether a reasonable time has elapsed and whether that guarantee has expired.
I don't understand. Why is Phelps Dodge, so is Phelps Dodge supposed to follow the ins and outs of the family relations, you know, the divorce and all that stuff? Is that what the guarantor is supposed to do? Does he have some duty of studying the conditions of his obligor? I don't get that.
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that...
So why should this separation of Horning and Schumacher mean anything to Phelps Dodge?
Well, it should mean something to Phelps Dodge that so much time had expired that it should expect.
I don't know why it should.
But it should expect. Should.
Well, that makes it sound as if... I don't even think there is a reasonable time rule. You know, I was struck by this in Mamaro, the case that the parties cite a lot, this Illinois case. So it says the guarantors could have limited their undertaking both as to time and amount had they seen fit to do so. But from a reading of the guarantee, it would seem that their desire and intention were that both should be unlimited. So why isn't our case the same? If you just read the guarantee, it looks as if it's unlimited as to time and scope and amount.
That's right, Your Honor. It does not state...
You know, if I had a guarantee like that, I'd say, well, look, I don't have to worry about this guarantee because it's completely, you know, it has no conditions, has no qualification, has no deadline. So as long as I'm selling, you know, copper wire, whatever... the Horning, I know that Schumacher is standing behind it. And what do I have to do? Every year I take it out and I call up Schumacher and say, you know, is your relationship with Horning unchanged? I don't get that.
No, I don't think that's right. But under the reasonable time rule, an elapse of a great amount of time does suggest and should suggest to the creditor that circumstances could have changed and that there wouldn't be a continuing relationship.
What's it supposed to do? I mean, is Phelps Dodge supposed to call up Schumacher and say, look, you know, this guarantee has been going on for 20 years. I don't know. We don't know. Would you like to revoke it? Hasn't it been a long time? Has it expired? Do you think it's expired? Is that what it's supposed to say? Say, we have this guarantee. Looks good, but maybe you think it's expired, right? Is that? I don't see that conversation as part of, you know, business ethics.
Well, I believe that Phelps Dodge did have to tell them
that they're taking advantage of you because Schumacher inexplicably failed to retain a copy of the guarantee.
I don't think that's true, Your Honor. There are two very specific risks in a guarantee that aren't in contract law. These guarantees are not read and construed simply as contracts on their face.
Why not?
Because the guarantor is waiting. It's separate. It doesn't have a continuing everyday relationship with the obligor.
Precisely. And of course, that cuts the other way. It means the guarantor... I don't mean the guarantor. I mean the recipient of the guarantee, Phelps Dodge, having this unlimited guarantee in hand, don't feel that they have to monitor their obligor's conduct and conditions and so on. Because they figure it's all taken care of by Schumacher.
They may feel that way, but that's certainly not the law of Illinois.
I mean, what are they supposed to do practically? Are they supposed to go to Schumacher and say what?
Well, whenever they change circumstances...
They just tear it up? They say it's 1990, we're going to tear it up, it's 20 years?
No, but when they change circumstances that materially affect the risk to the guarantor, and 30 years have elapsed, they certainly should tell the guarantor about those changed circumstances. And there is a very large body of case law throughout the country, and specifically in Illinois and in the circuit, that states exactly that rule.
Okay, so at what point do you think there was a change of which Phelps Dodge was required to notify Schumacher?
Well, certainly the several changes in the volume of copper sold, which were very dramatic.
Just give me the first change that they should have notified Schumacher of.
Well, I believe that would be the first change in volume of copper, which the most dramatic, I believe, was in 1990.
So, and what was this dramatic event?
Well, from 1984 through 1999, there was over a 50% increase in volume of copper. Actually, 60%.
Look, if something is changing at like 1% a year, right, continuous change, that doesn't sound like a material change. I thought you... That's why I asked, is there some dramatic... some break point where it's clear there's been a change so that Phelps Dodge was under a legal duty to notify Schumacher of that? Did it suddenly increase its volume of sales?
It did on several occasions, Your Honor, and those are certainly more than 1%.
One concrete, your best example of a dramatic change that required notification.
Well, there was an over 10% increase in the volume of copper sold by 1990.
What do you mean by 1990? That's not dramatic if that's 1% a year. So when was there a big change?
Well, also in 1990.
Maybe there was never a big change.
Well, also in 1990, Your Honor, the credit limit given to Horning was increased from 500,000 to 750,000 in 1 year. It's a 50% increase.
So that's an example of what you would regard as a material change requiring notice.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think here there are so many changes that it is very difficult
but
to determine exactly when
that occurred. But the
problem is, if you
have a guarantee that's unlimited, if you have a guarantee that foolishly is devoid of conditions and limitations, then doesn't that imply that a good deal of change will be entirely consistent? Because if you guarantee something forever, you know that there are going to be volume changes, interest rate changes, credit limit changes over the course of eternity.
But the guarantee is not forever. It does not specifically
say forever.
It certainly
looks like forever because it doesn't have a deadline in it.
It does not have a deadline, but guarantors are protected under the law of Illinois by the reasonable time rule and by the change in circumstances.
Not necessarily. You have this ambiguous this sentence I read from Amaro suggests that if it looks unlimited, if there aren't conditions in it. I mean, you could often infer a reasonable time limitation from some other kind of scope limitation, but you don't have that either. So it's like the Amaro guarantee, isn't it?
Well, I think it's very important that the law calls these not indefinite guarantees. They call them continuing guarantees. And that is what this is. It is
so
a continuing guarantee.
So they're revocable?
They are revocable, yes.
Well, why doesn't the power of revocation protect the guarantor? So he doesn't need a reasonable time limitation because whenever he feels the risks are increasing, that's of course related to the notice business, he can revoke.
I believe the law has developed in this area to protect the guarantor specifically against
his being dumped.
Indefinite,
right?
That's right, Your Honor. And abuse on the other side.
I don't see the abuse. I mean, Schumacher lost the guarantee. They executed a guarantee that was too broad, and then they lost it. I don't know that Phelps Dodge did anything bad.
Honor,
they just...
Whether it had been lost or not, these laws...
It has been lost, hasn't it?
It apparently was. There was no sign of it left.
Right.
But whether it had been lost or not is really irrelevant to both of these
doctrines. No, it's highly relevant because if you'd kept it, you could have revoked.
Well, even if we had kept it, even if Schumacher had kept the guarantee, it may not have revoked. And we would have been here in the same situation with the same law before us, the same two doctrines that require it to have expired by this time. Because of the specific nature of a guarantee as not just a general contract, but as a guarantee contract which keeps the guarantor, so to speak, away from the main sphere of action, where the obligor and the creditor are having a continuing day-to-day relationship, but the guarantor is waiting for some indefinite time in the future. This actually creates the situation, the very risk that's occurred in this case, where a guarantor may not be completely in the communication loop with the ongoing relationship between the other two parties, and even may, through the course of time and through changes in the relationships, even forget about a guarantee. And those are the two risks that separate guarantees from general contracts. And
now,
those are the two risks that require these
how big
doctrines.
How big is Schumacher?
I'm sorry?
How big is Schumacher?
It's a small family-owned company, Your Honor. I'm not sure how many employees, but certainly not more than 100 or so.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Ziska.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr.
Thank
Bobo?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel.
Let me just ask you before you begin, just you and your opponent both assume that the guarantee was revocable at any time. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
What does that come from?
It's in the restatement. I mean, I think it's black letter law, essentially.
Section
16 of the restatement third.
That a guarantee, if it doesn't have a
continuing guarantee, which is what that section refers to, and it's a subset of guarantees generally. There are all sorts of guarantees.
How do you recognize it as continuing, that it doesn't have a deadline?
Number one, it doesn't have a deadline. Number two, it contemplates a continuing course of dealing between the underlying parties. So Horning, the customer, was going to buy on open account a continuing series of copper, pay it. I mean, for as long as that relationship lasts. And, of course, Schumacher knew that because prior to that time, as you can easily see from the guarantee language itself, it had been the customer.
Okay, so you're saying a continuing guarantee is one where the amount of the debt isn't fixed, but it depends on continuing transactions,
the underlying relationship,
some particular debts, like.
Or surety, where you enter into a certain transaction and a third party surety stands behind that particular transaction that may expire, and typically does, I think, on its terms at a certain time. It doesn't contemplate an underlying ongoing series of relationships exactly as we have here. There's a couple of issues that I think the court should focus on that were brought up by counsel. Number one, as a discussion of this reasonable time aspect, and the counsel suggests that the important relationship that the cases talk about is there some change in the relationship between the guarantor and the principal obligor, or the customer. And I'm not quite sure where that comes from. The only two cases they cite related to that are cases Monroe Ready Mix and Epperson, neither of which are Illinois cases. But it's clear from a reading of those cases, Your Honors, that the relationship focused on by both of those cases is clearly that between the creditor, the seller of goods, and its underlying customer, the principal obligor. Actually, in both of those cases, it's clear from the facts that the guarantor, who was typically an officer, stayed and kept his employment. That wasn't a feature. So I think frankly, that's just a Schumacher misreading of those cases. And we cite a third case, the Suzio opinion, that makes that distinction quite clear. That's actually a case from the same jurisdiction as Monroe Ready Mix, so it distinguishes that case, saying, no, this reasonable time rule, if we're going to apply it, looks to see whether there was an interruption in this ongoing series of businesses. In one case, there was an interruption in the relationship of some 31 months, where simply the parties stopped doing business, and all of a sudden the seller begins to sell goods again. In one case, 31 months later, in another case, about 9 years later. And the courts in those cases said, no, that relationship was over. If you're going to start again after a hiatus of, whatever the time periods were, significant hiatuses, though, you need to go back, essentially, and get a new guarantee. And those were the applications of the reasonable time rule, and frankly, the only two applications of the reasonable time rule that either party cites before this court. Even Mamaroneck, Your Honors, a close reading of that will indicate that the time that the Illinois Supreme Court looked at there wasn't the time the guarantee was in effect. But it came up in a hypothetical, because, of course, Mamaroneck did uphold the guarantee. But it came up in a hypothetical discussion of, well, what if instead of selling on 30 days open account, what if the creditor started giving them 10 years or 30 years to pay? And the next sentence, which is what they quote, talks about, well, the time must be reasonable. It wasn't how long the guarantee lasts, but if, for example, Phelps Dodge, rather than selling on 30 days open account, all of a sudden says, oh, we'll give you 10 years to pay, don't worry about it. Well, you can understand why the courts would readily impose some sort of reasonable limits on time, but not the time of the lasting of the guarantee.
So that case stands for the proposition that you can infer a reasonable time term in a contract, in the underlying contract of sale between the creditor and the debtor, but not a reasonable time expiration of the guarantee.
That's correct. Now, it has been, of course, applied in that way, but to say that's the law in Illinois, and there is a Seventh Circuit case that mentions it without really analyzing it, and frankly goes the other way as well, that's the Hoyt case. There was no analysis of that there, and it's just mentioned in passing. But in terms of the law in Illinois, I think all one can derive from Mamorow, and again, this is dicta, but is there, the court can impose some sort of reasonableness on the time that credit can be extended so as not to overly burden a guarantor. Again, this goes back to really a risk sort of thing. This is consistent really with the overall body of law, which is if you're going to change the fundamental deal, in that case, if you're just going to greatly increase the guarantor's risk, well, you know, maybe there is some sort of reasonable provisions the court should protect the guarantor.
But of course, what's curious in this case is because of the lack of a time limit of the guarantee, so that the fact that the guarantee, you know, you're trying to enforce it, what, 30 years later?
30 years later.
Because of that, there are changes over the course of 30 years, obviously, in the relationship. Now, the individual changes are not particularly dramatic, perhaps. But if you compare the end with the beginning, there have been, you know, significant changes, volume, credit terms,
yes, sir,
interest, and so on. So what about the argument that at some point, we don't know what the point is, but at some point the change should be regarded as having become sufficiently great that a duty to notify Schumacher arose?
Well, let's take a look at that. And there is I don't know what to call it, a somewhat speculative discussion of all sorts of figures and facts in the reply brief. I don't think the court has to get into any speculation. The thing that's unusual about this case, perhaps, Your Honor, is the close relationship, and I mean very close relationship, between the Horning parties and the Schumacher parties, at least until they had this falling out in which they apparently just resumed business on what they call a more arm's-length basis. But the growth in the contracts, and you can tell this from the underlying contracts themselves, really happened before this falling out. The earliest contract that's in the record, and they're in the contracts themselves are in the stipulated record, is the 1984 contract. Now, this falling out happened apparently in about 1989. This 1984 contract.
Did the divorce, is that it? Or?
It was triggered by the death of the father. The divorce was in 85. The divorce was in 85. The Hornings separated at that time. And the father, Albert Schumacher, asked the CEO of Schumacher, who was Don Schumacher, his son, well, now that Mr. Horning is gone, go over there and you know, be the chief operating officer of Horning. So for this critical period in the mid-1980s, we had one person, Don Schumacher, the son of Albert, CEO of one company, COO of the other company. And that's pretty important here, Your Honor, because they're claiming, I don't know how, they're claiming that we didn't know what was happening at Horning. Well, let's examine the facts. Number one, the same fellow was, you know, at least if he wasn't running both companies, he was all but running both companies. Number two, Albert Schumacher was still around and was actively in both businesses. And number three, up until that point, the primary customer of Horning was Schumacher. So to the extent there was volume increase.
Did that change at any point?
Apparently, I think we're led to believe by the facts, by the stipulated record, that it changed after this family quarrel. The facts say they resumed doing business, but they don't. But we can't argue. I can't tell you that the facts say that they continued to be the primary customer in the 1990s. So at the time of the quarrel, they were the primary customer. After the quarrel, apparently there was a hiatus of about a year in the Horning Schumacher relationship, and then it resumed on, you know, one of several.
And this was a period when Don Schumacher was the COO of Horning?
He stopped being COO sometime after the death of his father when there developed apparently a quarrel.
Which was in 89, was it?
89, I believe. That's correct. But up until that point, Your Honor, the growth in the underlying contract had occurred by 1989. If you look at the 1989 contract, it's for a little over £7 million. And from there until the end of the relationship, although it varied a little bit, this is an annual poundage that you can see from the annual contract, they have a poundage specified. So from there until 2001, when this thing, you know, the music stopped essentially, the annual volumes in each of the contracts are in the $7 million range, sometimes higher, sometimes, you know, just at $7 million. The level in 1989 was £7,160,000.
Well, wait, you said both pounds and dollars.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to speak in pounds.
You mean pounds as a measure of weight or British pounds?
Pounds as a measure of weight.
Right.
It so happens that copper is sold on a... Well, it's a fluctuating... Sometimes it's under and sometimes it's over a dollar. If you were to ask me what's the average price of copper over a long period of time, it's probably going to be somewhere near a dollar. Perhaps that's the reason for my confusion. I apologize for confusing the court. In 1984, though, Your Honor, which is the earliest contract we have, the volume there was only 4.5 million pounds. So you can see, there was a dramatic increase. I guess that's dramatic. The 1988 contract, for example, which was Don Schumacher's last full year at the helm of Horning, was for 6.6 million pounds. Now, that's over 550,000 pounds a month. That's a lot of copper. And by the way, the largest single increase happened that year. If you look at the annual contracts, that year, 1988, that is the increase from 1987 to 1988, almost 900,000 pound increase.
Do you know how large the Schumacher company is?
Not exactly. I know that they are a privately held company. I know they do a lot of business with the mass merchants, Kmart, Sears, and the like for battery charging equipment. They're not public, so it's hard to really know, Your Honor. But in any event, there's no question that at least up until the time of this family spat, that not only was Schumacher well aware from its own reasons, but it was on top of it from both sides. And I can't. There's no essentially no significant growth thereafter. So yes, there had been growth in the relationship. Of course, there had been growth. Schumacher's own business was growing. Presumably, it needed the wire. Horning wasn't banking wire; it was just buying it. Excuse me, the copper and making wire for Schumacher.
Well, Mr. Ziska emphasizes that in 1990, which would be after Schumacher had died and Don Schumacher had left Horning, that the credit limit was raised by 50%. 500,000 to 750,000.
There are some instances where the credit limit went up, and there were some instances when later in the relationship the credit limit was lowered. Now, interestingly enough, Your Honor, the closing balance of $372,000 was well less than probably either of these numbers. In other words, if they're roughly a dollar a pound, give or take, in some cases more, it went apparently from $500,000, I have to think of which we're talking about, to $750,000. But Phelps Dodge then managed the relationship and managed the risk, really, for its own sake, but also in a secondary way for Schumacher as well. Managed the risk, ended up only $372,000 owing at the end of it. So there's no attempt here to take advantage of anyone just because it has a guarantee in its file. Unless there's any other questions, I would conclude my remarks. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pobo. Mr. Ziska, how much time does he have? No time? Would you like a minute? Do you have anything further you'd like to say?
I would like a minute.
Okay.
I would like to address one of counsel's remarks and then conclude. First of all, the Lawndale Steel case does specifically say that at the end of a guarantee, the size of the bag that's still being held, so to speak, and whether that was actually increased by the material changes over the years is irrelevant to the analysis in a change of circumstances doctrine case. So whether it was $372,000 at the end of the day or over $500,000 is really irrelevant in that doctrine. And finally, I'd like to say that guarantees present a very special circumstance under the law and allow a legal means for cooperation to be translated into additional competition. The cooperation of a guarantor allows an obligor to go into a market that may have significant entry barriers or to increase its market. Or to go into a new market through cooperation. That is why the law specifically favors guarantees and to increase the risk on guarantors by writing out these doctrines that protect guarantors will have an effect on both the robustness and the competition within our economy. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Your
Honor. Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel. Next case.